ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Kapila's Instructions on Devotional Service. Text 5. Monam Sat Asana Jaya.
Monam Sat Asana Jaya.
Sayam Prana Jaya Shanai.
Sayam Prana Jaya Shanai.
Yaharas Chenriyana. Monam Sarasana Jaya.
Monam Sarasana Jaya.
Sayam Prana Jaya Shanai.
Sayam Prana Jaya Shanai.
Yaharas Chandriyana.
Yaharas Chandriyana.
Visayan Manasa Riti.
Visayan Manasa Riti.
Monam Sarasana Jaya.
Yogi postures.
Jaya.
Controlling.
Stairyam.
Steadiness.
Prana Jaya. Controlling the vital layer.
Shanai.
Gradually.
Pratyahara.
Withdraw.
Cha.
And.
Indriyana.
Of the senses.
Vishaya.
From the sense objects.
Manasa.
The mind.
Riddhi.
On the heart. Translation. This is Lord Kapila Dev speaking. One must observe silence, acquire steadiness by practicing different yogic postures, control the breathing of the vital air, withdraw the senses from sense objects, and thus concentrate the mind on the heart. Purport. The yogic practices in general, and hatha yoga in particular, are not ends in themselves. They are means to the end of attaining steadiness. First, one must be able to sit properly, and then the mind and attention will become steady enough for practicing yoga. Gradually, one must control the circulation of vital air. And with such control, he will be able to withdraw the senses from sense objects. In the previous verse, it is stated that one must observe celibacy. The most important aspect of sense control is controlling sex life. That is called brahmacharya. By practicing the different sitting postures and controlling the vital air, one can control and restrain the senses from unrestricted sense enjoyment. Om Gyanachimidandasya Gyananjana Shalabhaya Chakshurumanitanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivastani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is the third canto of Bhagavatam, in the part where Lord Kapiladev is giving instruction. You may remember, in the earlier chapters, he instructs about fixing the mind completely on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then, in successive chapters, he starts talking about bhakti, of course, but mixed with Sankhya Yoga. How to analyze the material cosmos and get to the root. Not simply analyze. But the analysis, not done in a speculative way, is done according to the Vedic instructions and paradigm, all for the purpose of finding the root of existence and watering that root. Therefore, Epilde's instructions on Sankhya always are mixed with bhakti. Bhakti, as explained in the first canto of Bhagavatam, has two legs, jnana, knowledge, and vairagya, detachment. It is not just some kind of sentiment, as impersonalists think. It is not simply some religious belief, as theologians may think. Bhakti involves very profound elements. And even though those two elements, jnana, knowledge, and vairagya, detachment, are so important, still, separate from bhakti, they have no value. So this is a little, perhaps, paradoxical. Yes, we want knowledge, and yes, we want detachment, but what is the use unless those two are in relation to Krishna? So therefore, the first canto of Bhagavatam explains that the serious follower of the Vedas, someone who wants the conclusion of all the Vedas, always practices bhakti based on both jnana and vairagya, knowledge and detachment. And the whole purpose of the train running on those two rails, knowledge and detachment, the whole purpose is to arrive at the goal of focusing upon Krishna. So first, as we say, Kapilade talks about devotional service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and then explains it from a Sankhya angle of analysis in a couple of chapters. And now you're hearing Lord Kapilade explain bhakti from a yoga point of view. To understand the significance of his approach, we need to understand the elements of a real human civilization. Our main problem is that right now we think we're living in a human civilization. And that's what makes Bhagavatam difficult to understand. What's the relevance, really? I mean, I believe in it, of course. I was raised in that culture, or the culture's coming from my country, or I've been exhausted by material existence in the Western world, so bhakti sounds good. Sounds like a good belief to help me make it through the day and night. Lord Kapilade is explaining the Sankhya analysis, the yoga positioning, because in a real human society, those elements are prominent. And we need to hear that. Otherwise, we think that economic expansion with its booms and busts is the sign of real human intelligence. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says a very interesting thing about our problems in chanting Hare Krishna. He says, a major part of our problems in chanting Hare Krishna come from the notion that even though we are tiny and our senses are limited, yet, through scientific advancement and research, we can understand things that are beyond our senses. Now think about it. What's that got to do with my chanting? Think about it. What Srila Prabhupada calls the hypnotic process of research. With your imperfect mind and senses, you discover a little bit more than you knew. And you think, well, this is the way. I keep on. And I discover a bit more, and a bit more, and a bit more. You're hypnotized by that process. Some of you here are PhD researchers. You know how it goes. Not only are you hypnotized by the process, but you're hypnotized by the grants that you're getting. I always told you the story of how I was speaking at the Bubba Institute of Nuclear Research outside of Mumbai, you know, where all the top nuclear researchers in India are gathered. And so I was explaining to them that you're dealing with the most volatile technology. One slight human error, and there's havoc. So they were looking at me like, Swami, we've got everything under control. We know all the danger areas. There's backups and double backups and counter preventions and all this kind of thing. Don't worry, don't worry. We know what we're doing. We know. We are the cream of the nuclear scientists in the country. We know. So then I began to tell them about the news that the largest multinational corporation in the world, ExxonMobil, clear profits every year, clear profit, $56 billion every year. They were discovered to have paid off scientists to publish papers showing doubt in climate change. Bear in mind now, this is the third in a row record-breaking world year, 2016. Number three in a row for highest temperatures in known human history. Anyway, ExxonMobil, you know, they deal with petroleum. They don't want anyone cutting back on the petroleum. So, when you've got $56 billion a year clear profit, what's the problem in spending a few million on a slush fund for, as they put it when it was discovered, they said, look, we're just trying to inspire scientific research. We're just trying to make sure that all sides of the debate are heard. We're not taking any stances. We simply offered $50,000 to each scientist who could write a paper criticizing the idea of climate change. That's all we're just trying to level the playing field and make sure people hear all points of view. So just to inspire that, we offered $50,000 per published paper. So I pointed that out to the nuclear scientists at the Bubba Institute of Nuclear Research that, okay, I know you all have everything under control. You have so much integrity, and there's so many checks and double checks and triple checks in the system to make sure there's no nuclear disaster. But tell me, what would you do if ExxonMobil approached you with an offer of $50,000 for the first paper that you write that's published that disproves or casts doubt on a prevalent notion? What would you do? Everyone froze. I can see they're calculating. $50,000. What could that do in Mumbai? What could that buy in Mumbai? $50,000. And then I kind of poked them a bit more. I said, what do you think your wife would say? Everyone looked down at the floor. And you told your wife, take the money. We can go on a vacation, take the in-laws with us, take the money. Tired of riding around in this small, what's the small car called?
Huh?
Yeah, we're tired of riding around in that. We want a bigger car. So this hypnotic process of research doesn't simply apply to scientists, by the way. It also applies to any conditioned soul who is accustomed to getting information and making decisions based on limited and imperfect senses. That's why adults in particular have the idea that as they grow older, they grow in wisdom. Just because they learn not to repeat the mistakes they did when they were teenagers or in their 20s or 30s, when they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, they think, now we know. Right? It's like that, yeah? Especially you have children, then you have grandchildren. You know. You've seen it all. But how much have you seen? And what you have seen, is that enough to keep you from making the same mistakes in material existence? The basis of the mistakes is thinking, I shall chart my life. I will maneuver my life according to the inputs of my imperfect senses and others' imperfect senses. That's the basic mistake. So even for a non-scientist, that process is hypnotic. Yeah, I learned a bit. I won't repeat what I did last year. I'm getting a bit better in taking care of my life. No, from the Vedic point of view, you're just operating in the darkness, and every once in a while, you see some reflected light. Look at that. Look at that. I never saw that reflected light before. And you take the reflected light to be so important. You know, when you're walking on a dark street, and there's a few street lights, and cars that still have shiny metal on them, sometimes the light from the few street lights on the street shines off of the metal features of the car, and therefore there's a reflection, and you get a little light from that. So you think, oh, just see, there's illumination, I'm safe. Our chanting is affected by this attachment to getting knowledge through limited and imperfect senses. Why? Because we want, with our mundane senses, to verify that the Hare Krishna mantra works. We want to try to understand it with our limited and imperfect senses. So that attitude of being attached to the research attitude, the research capacity, that problem makes you speculate on the Hare Krishna mantra. Is it really working? I don't see it working. I mean, really, is Krishna the same as his name? The inputs to my material senses and intelligence aren't telling me that. So you feel a kind of schizophrenia in the morning, right? When you chant. Well, according to the Shastra, of course, Harinam, Harinam, even Kingdom, Ashdevan, Ashdevan, Jordan, come to the temple, Chaito, Darkana, Arjunam. But then you have two minds, right? You're of two minds, just schizophrenic. What are my imperfect limited senses telling me? What are others' imperfect limited senses telling them and me too? So therefore, you kind of become impeded or stymied in your chanting of Hare Krishna. And therefore, we just mumble it half-heartedly. You're supposed to do this. Otherwise, other devotees in the community think you're in Maya. So this is what you do to belong to the club. Club serves good food, so. This schizophrenia is based on attachment to getting knowledge through our imperfect limited senses. That problem even affects our chanting of Hare Krishna. This is a point explained by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. It takes a while. You have to think about it. It's like, well, what does attachment to the researching attitude have to do with my chanting? But what does the Shastra say? Atasri Krishna Namadi Nabhave Grayanindre. The name, form, qualities, and pastimes of Krishna cannot be perceived by material senses. Your only hope is Seva Mukhehi Jivada, devotional service beginning with the tongue. That is the authorized process to rise above the imprisonment by imperfect limited senses. When we hear about the yoga system, we may think, well, this doesn't really apply to us at all. One must observe silence, acquire steadiness by practicing different yogic postures, control the breathing of the vital air, withdraw the senses from sense objects, and thus concentrate the mind on the heart. We need to know the elements of a real human civilization, and they're fourfold. Of those four, three are transcendental, one isn't. First, there's karma. In a human society, karma is performed for the purpose of getting a better situation in the next life. That's the bottom of a real human civilization. Now, do you see people around you worried? How will my actions bring about a better birth in the next life? No, they're not concerned. In other words, you don't have a real human society. When you just perform karma for the sake of temporary material prosperity, temporary gratification, that is considered animal life. The animals are actually much better at that than human beings. Just living life based on the inputs of your senses and what's around you, that is animal life. Earlier in Bhagavatam, Lord Kapiladeva explained that whatever body that you take in material existence, you're not, when you're in that body, you don't feel averse to it. You feel at home in whatever body you take, whether it's human, worm, chicken, horse, you feel that this is the way it is, this is me. A human being who thinks, I am this body, and I just want to be concerned with actions that benefit my body in this lifetime, that's not actually human life. So when we understand the full spectrum of what of the elements of a real human civilization, then we can see, we can truly understand what is the situation now. So the bottom level in the Vedic system is karma. But karma for the sake of elevation to the heavenly planets. You see a very corrupted remnant of that in some of the Western religions. You want to go to heaven, but no knowledge of what is heaven, what you do there, what happens there. But still, that sentiment, we want to go to heaven. Believe and you will go to heaven. Without any concern for how actions produce reactions that you'll experience in the next life, then you don't have a human civilization. So, the entry level is understanding how karmic reactions affect lifetime after lifetime. That's not transcendental, that is material. Transcendental begins with jnana. You can get a partial understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead through jnana yoga. You can, although it's very difficult in the age of Kali, but in other ages it was possible that you could speculate your way into understanding and experiencing that there's an all-pervading spiritual reality known as Brahman. And if you go on that path to the end, you get a partial realization of Krishna. Krishna's impersonal aspect. Of course, the common mistake is to think, that's it, I've achieved the ultimate. All right, you're a transcendentalist, but you still haven't solved the ultimate problems of life. Until you act in your constitutional position as part of Krishna, you haven't solved the problems of life. The next element of a real human civilization is yoga. And that's what Lord Kapiladeva is talking about here. The proper goal of the yoga system, as stated in the purport, the yogic practices in general, and hatha yoga in particular, are not ends in themselves. You're meant to achieve the goal. What is that goal? Focusing on the super soul in the heart. Again, partial Krishna consciousness. But because the mystic yogis become attached to mystic powers, or they make the deadly mistake of thinking that they are the super soul, often they just stop and make a dead end. Lord Kapiladeva, of course, is always presenting the ultimate goal is bhakti. There, at that fourth element of a human civilization, you get complete realization of Krishna. By chanting Hare Krishna, you get all the benefits of Jnana Yoga, mystic yoga. You get the chance for immediate samadhi, focus on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The chance is there in your hand. Now, how much we make of that opportunity, that's up to us. But immediately, you are having the opportunity to be at the ultimate goal of Jnana Yoga, Jhana Yoga. It's right in your hand. I've often explained, a child may have a diamond in his hand. Do you know how valuable a diamond is? Never seen one before, have you? If we put a diamond in this little boy's hand, what will he probably do? Throw it somewhere, right? Oh, if he's a very good boy, he'll take it to his father. What is this, Papa? Papa, what is this? His father will say, "Oh, our family's not any fortunate." But if he's a typical little guy, like this one over here, he would probably swallow it and throw it away. Still, the fact is, he has a diamond. Similarly, we have opportunity for samadhi. Focus on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is real samadhi, not focus on the impersonal Brahman or Paramatma, the super soul in the heart. Now, what we do with that opportunity, that's up to us. But it is the transcendental fact that chanting Hare Krishna gives you the ultimate benefits of all the other processes of self-realization. Which, by the way, don't work in Kali Yuga. Chanting Hare Krishna, as Chaitanya Charitamrita explains, is the only process of self-realization that is free of material contamination in the Kali Yuga. So you have the easiest way, and you have the only effective way. So often, when we do outreach programs, people ask, "So, are you saying your way is the only way?" No, we're not saying our way is the only way. We just say our way is the only way that works in the present day and age. No, no, there are other ways. In a real human civilization, there are other ways. For example, you can perform karma, go to the heavenly planets, which is a totally material goal. But when you're in the heavenly planets, you may start taking advantage of opportunities to elevate yourself spiritually. And there is a path back to Godhead through the heavenly planets. Problem is, it doesn't work in this day and age because people don't have the necessary qualifications, lifespan, mental clarity. So yes, there's another way. It just happens not to work in the present circumstance. Jnana, speculation. Everyone knows, so much talk about how it's all one, and there's the oneness. But when you look at the lifestyle of such persons, you find they're simply merged in the material energy. Yoga. There can be so many postures, so many breathing exercises. But as Krishna explains in 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Yogi Nama Visarvesha, the topmost yogi is the one who's always thinking of me. Can you perform the Eightfold Yoga System in this day and age and get to the point of always thinking of Krishna? Practically impossible. Therefore, as Srila Prabhupada would always say, even Arjuna, who is qualified like Arjuna, even Arjuna says to Krishna, impossible. So when we say only bhakti, first of all, we're repeating the Shastra. And secondly, that statement of ours is based on comprehensive knowledge that although there are other paths, they don't work in this age of Kali. They don't get you to bhakti in this lifetime. And anyway, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Bhakti-mam-abhijana. Only by bhakti can I be understood. Because the circumstances of society are so hideous these days, Lord Chaitanya is giving immediate access to Krishna. But here's the thing. We read these verses about yoga, sense control, postures, controlling the breathing of the vital air, withdraw the senses from the sense objects, concentrating the mind and the heart. And we say, well, what's that got to do with us? All we have to do is believe in Krishna. No. Bhakti is about lifestyle. You are all yogis or aspiring yogis. Yogis in devotion. That means discipline, focus, things to do, things not to do. So many of you are working in the IT world, the finance world, the corporate world. Do your masters at work simply want that you believe you have a job? Is that your qualification? Is that your contribution? I believe that I'm part of this company. I believe I'm part of this particular IT department. No, they want to see you rigorously adopt the lifestyle of that work. They want to see how all your senses are engaged with discipline and focus. Similarly, bhakti is not just about believing in Krishna. It requires career discipline. So this is a point that separates casual persons who contact bhakti and those who are serious. Make bhakti your career. Everyone knows what it's like to push on a career. You've got to be focused. You've got to be dedicated. You have to be tolerant. Why not with bhakti? Look at it as a career. It's the topmost yoga discipline. But that bhakti is beyond the yoga system, or the goal of the yoga system, doesn't mean we just dismiss crucial items like observing silence. What does that mean for the bhakti yogi? Silence? It means not speaking material sound vibration. Acquire steadiness by practicing different yogic postures. We acquire steadiness by studying transcendental knowledge and by chanting Hare Krishna. Controlling the breathing of the vital air. Chanting Hare Krishna is the best pranayama. It's the best use of your breathing to vibrate the Hare Krishna mantra. Withdraw the senses from the sense objects. You do that by using everything in Krishna's service, including your senses. Let your senses only act for Krishna's pleasure. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvatthakura explained that his whole outreach mission was based on two principles. Number one, do not practice artificial renunciation, rejecting things that could be useful for Krishna's pleasure. And number two, whatever you come in contact with, use it for Krishna's pleasure. That is real renunciation. Not turning your back on what is meant to be engaged in Krishna's service. So he said his whole outreach mission was based on those two principles. That is pratyahara, withdrawing the senses from the sense objects. But it's not that you're going in seclusion and doing that. No, you're using your senses to please Krishna. You're using the sense objects around you for Krishna's pleasure. Therefore, you can concentrate the mind on the heart. But what actually happens when the Vaishnava concentrates on the mind and the heart? The ultimate goal is to see Shyam Sundar in the core of one's being. By engaging everything in Krishna's service with discipline and focus, that goal is achieved. Once we understand what the elements of a real human civilization are, then we can see how unfortunate people are today. But we get so mesmerized, hypnotized by the spreading of technological gadgetry, its proliferation. Oh, now things are becoming more advanced. When actually what's simply going on? People are having to work harder and harder and harder and having less and less time for thinking what is the ultimate goal of life. I've been explaining in Sydney last weekend, for example. The latest thing that you're going to see is no longer the work-life balance. At our retreats, I often get that question. How do you balance work and life? That is not the latest style. The latest thing, which will soon spread all over the world, it's coming out of Silicon Valley, is called work-life integration. Why should you have a separate life from your work? Work, the workplace, should provide everything. Your financial remuneration, emotional satisfaction, physical fitness, you name it. The desire for respect, relationships, the workplace should provide all that so that you practically never go home. Why should you go home? There's just relationship problems there. Why not stay at work? Everything is there. This is being pioneered by Google and Facebook. They have campuses, you know. All our IT people know. It's the cutting edge, right? Those kind of working circumstances. Work-life integration. They have campuses. You have your place of work, but then you just walk right out your office door and there are 10 different cafes serving global cuisine. There are fitness centers. And of course, a yoga room and meditation room, certainly. There are parks for you to sit down and try to establish or repair relationships. Everything you want is there. Swimming pools. Why should you go home? You can have a full life at the workplace. So this is called work-life integration. Forget the balance. Merge it all. So that you have staff, employees, who are just 100% in samadhi on the goals of that particular entity, that particular business. That's what you want. And it's coming your way soon. Why should you have a separatist attitude of thinking there's home life and work life? This is nonsense. It is destroying productivity. Why should you feel like you have to go home? No, what they want is the few times when you do go home, you're thinking, why do I have to be here? That's the idea. I want to hurry up and get back to work. One news reporter was describing how life works on these campuses. And lunchtime, so many wives are driving up in their car with a kid or two in the car, and just to visit daddy, you know, break time. So the journalist was saying, it's like kind of families visiting prisoners. Official visiting time. Get to see your daddy, you know, while he's working 80 hours a week. Because that's what's going on. The people are working 80 hours a week and loving it. They even have, whether it's, I think it's either, I can't remember which one, Facebook or Google, they have a t-shirt printing office, which prints t-shirts with slogans on them, like, I love my job. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. You put the t-shirt on and everyone knows that you are really a part of the scene there. All kinds of productivity slogans are produced, printed on t-shirts. So you get into the perverted bhakti, you know? They don't want you simply to come to work mechanically. They want pure devotion. So this is what's going on. You're forced to be so serious about your work life. But when it comes to bhakti, well, you know, I believe in Krishna. My grandmother read me stories from Mahabharata when I was 6. That's what it's all about. No, this is the most serious career undertaking. And therefore, all the aspects that Lord Kapiladeva is describing that refer to the classic yoga system, which Krishna summarizes in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, all that is perfectly utilized in bhakti yoga. So let's not make the mistake of thinking that we're just part of a casual belief outfit. What do you believe? Do you believe that Vishnu came from Krishna or Krishna came from Vishnu? What do you believe? It is important, of course, to have the proper philosophical understanding, but let us not overlook the elements of our lifestyle that always need to be honed and improved. That is yoga. And bhakti yogis are the topmost yogis. That means all their life, all aspects of their life are under control, focused. This is our lifetime career, constantly honing our lifestyle. Not that, okay, I believe in Krishna. That's it. I've done all I can do. I've got the right beliefs. No. How is your lifestyle increasing in focus on Krishna? How is the samadhi increasing? Therefore, let's not put our noses up in the air when Lord Kapiladeva is describing the classic yoga system. We need to remember that we are part of the most serious undertaking, the best career. Our career needs discipline, mind and sense control. It needs knowledge, of course. It needs detachment. We always have to keep our eyes on the meter of our life. What is that gaze showing? How much focus is there on Krishna? Sometimes we have a tendency, because we're in material nature, to lose the focus of it. So we have to be on top of that. This is the life of a bhakti yogi. It is the most glorious life in existence. And it's based on something far beyond simple belief. So we're grateful for Lord Kapiladeva for telling these things, because it makes us realize the aspects of a real human civilization, which we don't have today. And it also teaches us elements that should be there in our bhakti life, so that we actually increase our focus on Krishna by always thinking, what is best for Krishna's service? What's best for Krishna's pleasure? That is the pinnacle of existence. Therefore, as Srila Prabhupada said, when he came to Melbourne, If you think that everything is meant for Krishna's pleasure and how you can contribute to Krishna's enjoyment, you're no longer in the material world. That's samadhi. Any questions? Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. You said about a person who is researching about the process. As a novice, every devotee is a bit inquisitive as well as skeptical. So where should one draw the line between inquisitiveness and skepticism, and how should one go about that?
Doubting is the sign of human intelligence until you are in contact with a proper source of knowledge. So, yes, you should be doubtful. And Kapila Dev talks about that in the third canto. Doubt and its proper use. Until you come across an authoritative source of knowledge, it is normal to doubt. It is good to doubt. But after you come in contact with an authorized source of knowledge, doubting is foolish. Skepticism means I've been disappointed so many times, I'm sure I'm going to be disappointed again. But what is the use of skepticism if you're in contact with a genuine source of knowledge? So once we understand that Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is giving us perfect knowledge, then what is the need for doubt? But yes, we have to make progress to come to that point of understanding who is Krishna and the value of what Krishna is saying. Just like if you're married, you have a son, just like he has a son. Suppose his son comes to him and says, "Father, you know, how old are you?"
"Seven."
"I'm 7 years old, but you know, I've been having doubts that you're my father." The father would be astonished, like, "Son, I mean, it's so obvious. You know, I'm authorized, you know. What do you want, a DNA test?" The father has the knowledge that I'm your father, you're my son. I'm aware of the whole process, how you were conceived, how you were born, how you grew up. What's the difficulty? Still, "Father, I have doubts. I'm skeptical. I know other children, they don't know who their father is. So therefore, I'm skeptical about the whole principle of fatherhood and childhood." So then the father explains systematically, "This is why you can be sure I'm your father." So if the son continues to remain doubtful, what does that mean? He's foolish. He's in the presence of authorized knowledge. He has access to that knowledge. But still, because of hearing from those with negative experiences, he's skeptical. "Father, yeah, everything you said to me makes sense. I totally accept everything you say is true, but I know others who don't know who their father is. Therefore..." Our good fortune is what? Our good fortune is that we are in contact with an authorized source of knowledge. Bhagavad Gita is bringing you closer to Krishna, not taking you away from Krishna. That's why Srila Prabhupada always established the significance of Bhagavad Gita as it is. A genuine Bhagavad Gita directs your attention to Krishna, not away from Krishna. So as you become more convinced by knowledge and the application of knowledge that you have the most authorized source of knowledge, then you'll realize, what's the point in being skeptical? Doubting has a use up until a point. If you go on doubting past that point, then you're being very unfortunate. Our whole purpose of a human life is to come in contact with the genuine source of knowledge. Remain skeptical up to that point when you're in contact. Skepticism is a bit irrational. It's like, well, I've been let down so many times in the past. I'm simply going to be let down again and again. If it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have any luck at all. It's an old blues song from the USA. You don't know anything about that, did it? That's another one. No one loved me but my mother, and she could be tricking me too. Skepticism. Everything I've experienced is negative. So, therefore, why should I trust Krishna? Is Krishna just ramming Bhagavad Gita down your throat? No, he's explaining from this angle, that angle. He's giving you the process to verify what he's saying about it. And if we're still skeptical, that means we're nonsense. So therefore, get to the root of someone's skepticism by pointing out, do you understand what kind of knowledge you're in contact with and who is speaking that knowledge? Okay. Yes.
Maharaj talked about how sometimes we have this tendency to check with our mind and senses. So even when it comes to devotional service, we check with our mind and senses and how we feel. And
can you give me an example?
Just doing any service, for example, going for book distribution or just waking up in the morning. The mind and senses tell us not to do it, but even if we force ourselves to do it, we're half-hearted about it, and then the devotion next week doesn't come.
But still, did you get out the door? Yes? Even your mind and senses may be saying, don't do this. Don't do this devotional service. But still, you go out the door and do it, right?
I try to, but sometimes I find some other services that's a bit more easier to do.
Outreach is not easy all the time. It is a fact. You're dealing with sick persons who think they're perfectly healthy. So yes, it can be, it can seem like there's so many obstacles. That's why Krishna says no one is more dear, nor will there ever be one more dear than one who tries to give the bhakti science to someone else. There are agonies and ecstasies in outreach. You know, sometimes on book distribution you're flying. Wow, this is, I'm feeling ecstatic. Other times, it's like someone's pulling your teeth. Therefore, our foundation is not so much on how we feel. Our foundation is duty. Duty consciousness leads to raga, spontaneous attraction. One devotee once presented himself to Srila Prabhupada. This is the early days. Prabhupada, you ask me to go to the store to get a certain thing for the temple. And on the way to the store, so many thoughts were in my mind. What do I do? So the Prabhupada looked at him and said, well, did you go to the store? In other words, first duty and commitment. And gradually then, the mind comes under control, as you're always thinking how to please Krishna. But first, duty and commitment. If you just take a reading on your mind before you do any devotional service. How do I feel today? Am I blissful? Most of the time, you're not going to do very much Krishna conscious activities. Recognize that we're in the disease stage of life. We need to do what's necessary so we become healthy. Or look at it another way. In the beginning of bhakti, performed according to duty, regulation, commitment, that is the stage of recuperation, regaining our health. The next stage is the relishing stage. You've ever been very sick? What kind of disease? What health problem?
Fever.
Did you demand when the doctor gave you some remedy? No, I want to, right now, I have to feel good, right now. Did you demand that? No. If the doctor could explain to you, take this and gradually you'll become healthy. You were satisfied, right? You didn't explode. Why can't I feel perfectly healthy right now? I want to feel good right now. No, you were happy if the doctor could present to you a whole plan for recuperation and gradually getting your health back. So why then, when it comes to bhakti, we're so impatient and so childish? Krishna, I just don't feel like it today. Even sometimes you may hear distortions of the bhakti science that you should only chant when you feel like it. Krishna appreciates it more that way. So when you feel like chanting your rounds, that's when you chant. Otherwise, if you have to force yourself to chant, why should you do that? That's not bhakti. So can you see yourself telling the doctor, yes, I'll take the medicine when I feel like it. It's like I had an experience just yesterday. I was talking to one Ayurvedic doctor in Wellington. She can be very insistent. You have to do this. You have to do this. Now, I've seen enough Ayurvedic doctors in my time to know that every doctor has a different opinion from the other doctor. But she said, no, no, you must do this. You must do this. You're going to do it, right?
I would just look away.
You're going to do it, right? Because I know, like, when I go to Mumbai, if I see an Ayurvedic doctor in Mumbai, he's going to say, no, 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 that's not necessary. You should do like that. Doctors, they expect that you follow their instruction. If you tell them you don't feel like it, they understand. You're not serious about getting well. Lord Chaitanya is the supreme physician. Chaitanya Vaija. His cures work. Whether you feel like it or not, you take the cure. And gradually, your spontaneous attraction for glorifying Krishna will develop. That's the real career. Developing raga. Spontaneous attraction for serving Krishna, glorifying Krishna, chanting Hare Krishna. Anything else? Yes? Oh, Aniruddha Prabhu, Hare Krishna.
Work-life balance in the Hare Krishna river can be a challenge because we're supposed to be 24 hours engaged in Krishna service, but we can also approach that situation where we actually exhaust ourselves and we find that we're not able to do anything just talking to you earlier this morning, you're saying, yeah, work is tough, and then the weekends are even tougher. So I've got to preach and do this and do that and do the other thing for Krishna, right? So how do we take the principles of this, the Philodaros engagement in yoga, get that balance also as a devotee, because we can also, even as devotees, we can sometimes, and I've done it myself, fall into the corporate trap of just working, and not being balanced even in our devotional practices and our preaching, I guess you could say, so that we have a kind of a normal life.
Well, of course, you answered your own question. That devotee came to you to ask you. In other words, the devotee's recognizing bhakti requires guidance. So we came to you. And
well, he didn't come to me. We were just having a chat.
He's taking advantage. You both are taking advantage of the association of devotees. Bhakti is meant to be performed in the association of devotees. So you both were taking advantage of that. In that association of devotees, there's fraternal relations, friendly relations, there's relations with superiors. So there's all kinds of support. The support coming from friends, the guidance coming from superiors, the enthusiasm coming from your juniors. It's all there. Otherwise, yes, it can be a bit tricky. How do I know when I'm exceeding my capacity based on my limited body and mind? Maybe I need to rest this weekend. By serving Krishna in the association of devotees, you develop a feel. It's like riding a bicycle, driving a car. Sometimes you go too far this side to the right side, sometimes to the left side, but you correct it. You keep everything centered. Gradually you'll realize this is all part of love. How can I best serve Krishna? Should I take more rest? Take rest less? Krishna will give you intelligence if your goal is simply how to please him. So don't make bhakti into some kind of torturous ordeal. Oh, how do I know? Oh, gosh, how do I know? Should I spend more time with my family, or should I not? You talk with your peers, you take guidance from your superiors, and you also watch your juniors and their enthusiasm. And gradually it all becomes clear. The purpose of bhakti is not to confuse you, befuddle you, bewilder you. I'll never know what to do. And if you have any doubts about what to do, what's your recourse that you can always do? Chant Hare Krishna. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't figure out whether I should spend more time with this or spend more time with that, less time with this, less time with that. So I decided to chant Hare Krishna. One devotee was relaying the story that happened in Hyderabad. Anybody here from Hyderabad? Yes. So Srila Prabhupada was trying to establish a farm project there. And he had put a leader in charge and sent some other devotees there too. And while he was gone, somewhere else in India, those leaders were battling. Oh, they couldn't agree on anything. So the whole progress of the project was in danger because these three seniors couldn't get along. But Srila Prabhupada came back and first he told them, look, you all just go outside in the back, fight it out like cats and dogs, and then come to some solution. Come back with a solution. So they tried to do that. They went out in the back, as Prabhupada said, hey, you didn't do that. Yelling at each other. Guru's instructions. So they really got into it. You remember when So they did it, but they felt they didn't resolve everything. So they all three marched back to the house to see Prabhupada and to show him that they followed his instructions, but it didn't work. And they got to where the room where Prabhupada was in. They walked in, and there was Prabhupada just sitting back on his cushions, just Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. They were just totally overwhelmed by the beauty of seeing Prabhupada relishing the Hare Krishna mantra. His tongue was like licking each syllable. He was sucking the nectar of every syllable. All three of them were just transfixed. And then after chanting for some time, they also began to chant with Prabhupada. Prabhupada looked at them and said, if you don't know what else to do, just chant Hare Krishna. Who can fault you? I didn't know what to do in this moment, whether to turn right or left. So I chanted Hare Krishna. Oh, Prabhu, you're mine. No. When in doubt, chant Hare Krishna. When not in doubt, chant Hare Krishna. Why is there not enough enthusiasm?
The one enthusiasm which was there in the initial years, the newness of bhakti.
What I recommend in those circumstances is based on the Bhagavatam saying that it's the super soul in the heart who makes everything eternally fresh for the devotee. So you pray to Krishna, I've got an attitude problem. My material perceptions are overwhelming me. I'm seeing devotional service and chanting Hare Krishna as the same old. I know I'm wrong. Please correct my perception because you are the Lord of perception. Matasmritiya, Gyanam Upavanam Cha. From you comes all knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. You're in my heart. Let me see differently. So that's what I recommend. Understand who is the control of your perception and appeal to him. I want to see differently. When I was a new devotee, I saw glories everywhere. I saw all the other devotees as shining. Now, as the years have gone by, perhaps due to familiarity, my vision has become affected. I'm just a tiny part of Krishna. I'm begging to the master of the senses, please allow my senses to experience the genuine reality which is ever fresh. Just like Krishna's Navayovanam, ever youthful, certainly devotional service is ever fresh. So it's a good time when what you describe happens, it's a good time to acknowledge your dependency and helplessness. In fact, that's the best way to chant Hare Krishna, with an attitude of helplessness. My mind and senses are telling me this, but I'm crying out to you, Krishna, because my mind and senses are cheating me. Even though I'm attached to them, they're misleading me. I'm calling out to you. You're the master of the senses. Let me not become overwhelmed by my mundane sense perception. Let me see your glories everywhere. Let me see opportunities for serving you everywhere. So it's a great opportunity when you hit those dry spells, where all the nectar seems to have dried up. It's a great opportunity to go deeper. And Krishna knows how to manage his devotee. He knows how to sometimes apparently disappear from us, so we'll call out for him with even more dedication. That's his specialty. He certainly does it in Vrindavan. He even told his dearmost devotees, don't be angry at me, don't think that I disappeared from you for no purpose at all, just to make you miserable. No, I was actually watching you and your feelings of separation. You didn't know, but I was watching you. What do you think? Someone very dear to you goes away from you, and you think all is lost. And then later the person says, well, you didn't see me, but I was watching you in your desperation. Why would Krishna do something like that? Is he a sadist? No. He said, I know what I'm doing. I know the psychology that if someone's been poor all their life, this is from the beginning of Rasa Lila, someone who's poor all their life, if they suddenly get some wealth and then they lose it, they never stop thinking about that wealth. I know what's going on. Therefore, I treat my devotees like that. They feel separation from me. And in fact, as Lord Chaitanya demonstrates, love of Krishna and separation is the ultimate experience in the spiritual world. So Krishna wants to give that ultimate experience. So even in our beginning and intermediate stages of bhakti, Krishna is not lazy in our heart, as Prabhupada said. He knows how to make you long for him more. So when the so-called dry periods come, it's a great chance to increase our intensity. A devotee is someone who knows how to use everything to increase the bhakti. Even when you think, I'm not so enthusiastic. It's a great time to increase. And Krishna will give you intelligence how to do it in your particular circumstances. Because bhakti is not dependent on material circumstances. Whatever situation we're in, there is an opportunity to increase the bhakti. And if nothing else, just chant Hare Krishna. And you won. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.